A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away, well, actually it was just a few weeks ago, in a theater near you, that Star Wars The Rise of Skywalker came out. And as promised, we're here to talk about it on the Think Christian podcast. There's no such thing as secular, after all, even in popular culture, and maybe especially in Star Wars. I'm Josh Larson. It's good to be back for the second year of the podcast. It is 2020, but we still have some unfinished business from 2019, The Rise of Skywalker and The Mandalorian, the Star Wars series that recently wrapped up its first season on Disney Plus. Now, at Think Christian, we've been keeping close tabs on Star Wars since this latest feature film trilogy was kicked off in 2015 with The Force Awakens. We've written about the saga many times on our website, thinkchristian.net. We also produced an ebook, A Theology of Star Wars, and that includes essays on 8 of the 9 feature films that are considered part of the Skywalker saga, so we go all the way back to 1977 Star Wars. You can get that ebook for free at thinkchristian.net/Star Wars. We are working on updating that right now with a final essay written by Claude Acho on The Rise of Skywalker. But you can get a sneak peek of Claude's essay on our website, thinkchristian.net. It is live there now. You can also get a sneak peek on this episode. Claude's going to join me to talk about the theological resonance he found in the movie. Then Sarah Welch Larson will jump on to discuss The Mandalorian. I wonder if there's a theology of Baby Yoda. Claude Acho is doing triple duty for us. He not only wrote about The Rise of Skywalker on the TC website, that post is up there now, but we're going to adapt that essay into our ebook and complete that ebook with it. And now he's here to talk about the movie with me for the podcast. Claude, first though, I want to get a little bit of your history with Star Wars. I've got some years on you, so the Star Wars action figures that are in my attic, they go all the way back to the early 1980s. But how about you? When did you first encounter this cultural behemoth, and what does it mean to you?
So I was late to Star Wars in a couple of respects. I remember probably like 5th or 6th grade, so this would have been like 98 or something. I remember going to a friend's house and I don't know how, but we started watching them. So what I remember is really the Ewoks from Return of the Jedi. I think I was just like, this is fine. Like, what is this? And then as I realized it was a huge cultural deal, I basically resisted it as kind of like, you know, nerdiness, even though in my own ways, I was a nerd too. And so I kind of resisted it. And so in college, I came back and watched them all. And I really liked actually episode 3, just because it was dark and moody and broody, and then really enjoyed, you know, the first one, A New Hope, or just Star Wars. So I kind of came around to it. And then really it was actually seeing The Force Awakens in theaters that was just a really happy, special, exciting moment for me, because it was really a first like organic connection with those movies. And so, you know, I think for a lot of people, it was a retreading of story beats, which they appreciated or maybe didn't like. But for me, it was almost like my first magical encounter with Star Wars. So
Okay. That's
how it kind of started for me. So dabbing my toes in pretty slowly. And after The Force Awakens, I kind of went back and watched the originals and really have enjoyed them since.
Yeah, that's a unique path, I bet. A lot of people probably come to it sooner as kids and then work their way to the other movies. I know maybe the first 2 prequels you don't like as much. I'm a fan of all of them, but I'm glad that they played a formative part in your Star Wars experience too, because
they did help. Yeah, they helped a little bit.
I do defend those. Let's move on to Rise of Skywalker. And before we do that, we should probably note we are going to get into spoilers. So if anyone is listening who hasn't seen the film yet and might not want to hear about, you know, the major reveal as well as the other twists and turns, there's a lot of them in this movie, I would suggest setting aside this episode till after you've seen the movie would be smart. Or if you are interested in just hearing about The Mandalorian, you could probably fast forward about 15 minutes or so. And that's when we'll be at that part of the conversation with Sarah Welch Larson. But for now, with The Rise of Skywalker, Claude and I are definitely going to get into some spoilers. Now, your essay, Claude, it centers on Rey, played by Daisy Ridley, and I'm glad you took that direction because she's become the central figure of this latest trilogy. She's a fascinating character. When we first met her in The Force Awakens, she was this orphaned scavenger on the desert planet of Jakku. She has vague memories of her parents leaving her behind in distress and even vaguer hope, I think, that they might one day return. And then as the films have gone on and Rey has fallen in with the resistance, this freedom movement that's fighting against the fascist First Order, she learns that she has a strong connection to the saga's fabled force. And so there's been this continual question through these last three films of what that might mean for her identity. Basically, Rey's trying to find out who she is and where she belongs. So, Claude, what do you think of how that finally played out in The Rise of Skywalker? And maybe talk a little bit about the Christian significance that you found in that.
So I didn't see any trailers or anything for the movie heading in. So I just stayed away from all of that. And so, you know, watching the movie and, you know, the famous text crawl upward and kind of realizing like, oh, okay, like this is going to move us back and we're going to see Palpatine and all of these things. I didn't have any clues or hints to that. And, you know, I think a lot of people maybe were able to kind of read the tea leaves and know that things were going to move that way. And so Rey having her lineage of Palpatine being his granddaughter, I kind of had to sit with that for a little bit because at first I was like, oh, this is sort of a retread the way The Force Awakens was in some respects, like just sort of cycling us back to these characters that we know. But then as I thought about it, I really came to appreciate that because I think it actually makes Rey really relatable as a character, that as our hero that we identify with and the character that is really magnetic, I think it shows us that even someone like her has to grapple with and overcome evil and has to overcome that in a very personal way, as opposed to having to overcome a different set of challenges that come with being an orphan. I think just the final hurdle of like confronting the sort of evil lineage that's tied to you and what that might mean for you is immediately like resonant, I think, with everyone, I think, who does a sense of kind of introspection, but especially with, you know, the Christian story of having to overcome sin in our lives of our own sort of volition or just around us, that we have to reckon with it if we're going to move forward with our place in the world and our place in God's story. And so, you know, I thought it was a really great storytelling choice, but one that really, I think, makes her journey one that I could relate with and really like admire.
Yeah, it surprised me too. I'm like you, I think I saw like a teaser trailer at some point accidentally, but otherwise really avoided anything, even images from it. And so I had no idea that it would go this route. And it kind of took me back as well. The familiarity of it, I thought was, you know, maybe a little disappointing. But the way you talk about it, I think, does reveal what's interesting about it. I like the way you put it in your essay. You said in the economy of Star Wars, to be a nobody is morally neutral, which is, you know, again, interesting to think about Rey being a nobody and coming from a family of nobodies. But then you say to be revealed as a Palpatine is a massive moral and existential burden not easily overcome. And so there's maybe more or a different sort of wrestling that's going to take place. And then what I really liked about what you wrote is how you connected this to how she responds to it is partly a heroic act. Rey is very much an active figure, but it's partly in response to things that are offered to her, right? As she kind of becomes more involved with some of the characters in the Resistance or even some of the beloved characters from the original franchise.
Yeah. And I think what I really came to appreciate about the movie, even though, you know, I have my quibbles and I think there's some ways I was disappointed, but I think the through line of Rey's story has just enough of that Star Wars magic that I think it's special and good in its own ways. But, you know, I think we can relate to Rey so much because who among us hasn't had those moments where something is revealed to us about us or that we're connected to that sort of like peels back the layers of character or history, and then we kind of see what's underneath. And then we just kind of like tremble, like we're just totally undone when we realize like, man, you know, these things, these flaws in me are still there. Like I've got to reckon with these, you know, I just really related to that. And I think that's especially true in just our Christian journey of sanctification and recognizing that there's always the work of repentance and overcoming sin and temptation and evil in and around us. And so that just meant so much to me on a personal level.
Yeah, and we've talked about Rey being, you know, somewhat of an orphan here at the beginning, but I like how that's carried through where it's almost an experience of adoption she has in The Rise of Skywalker when she responds to Leia, played by Carrie Fisher, who, although she passed away before this film was completed, they had footage from The Last Jedi that they were able to use. And she really is this mentor to Rey in some of those early scenes and offers Rey a home, a place to be, a place to learn, a place to grow. As you said, a place to face the darkness in her past. And I didn't think about the angle that you took in your piece where you see the significance of Leia doing that, even though she knew ahead of time of Rey's identity as a Palpatine. So Leia knew of her sin, we could say, yet still reached out to her and offered her this place. And just that as a metaphor for grace, I think is really powerful for Christians who are watching this. And then just on the basic narrative level of Rise of Skywalker.
Yeah, I agree. I think those two turning points in the movie, the news that comes early of the revelation, the bad news revelation that she is a Palpatine, that comes from Kylo Ren. And you know, I mentioned it in the article and the piece as well, that I love the place that it happens and the dark, broody night. And she's kind of on the edge of the landing bay dock. And, you know, she's pushed up against the edge as she gets this news that could also push her over the edge, you know, in terms of her identity and over to the dark side. And so she gets this bad news. And then really the parallel counter of that in the movie towards the end of second act, breaking into the third act of the movie, that sort of typical crisis point in the movie, she's in a self-imposed exile and Luke brings her good news. And so you get like bad news overcome by good news. And it's just such a picture of the Christian story. And it's so beautiful. And I think despite a lot of ways that maybe we could quibble with the movie, I think it really nails it on those two story points that are just so resonant with what it means to know and to follow Jesus, that our story really hinges on how do we receive the bad news about us, which there is bad news about us, right? And then, you know, how will we receive the good news? And I think it just gives great prominence to the act of grace that Leia does in receiving Rey, knowing all that she knows. I thought it was so cool too that the movie makes a big point of the one time where Rey calls her master, you know, and it's special on a lot of levels, but I think obviously the Christian resonance too is really neat. Like, you know, she so joyfully says that to Leia early in the movie. And so it's just so beautiful to see that she's been embraced by her in ways she doesn't even know.
Yeah, it does make you wonder about what was lost with the loss of Carrie Fisher, in how much more of that might have been in this movie. I had a favorite scene in the film that also involves Rey, and it touches on this totally different theological notion, but I think it's one that runs through the entire Star Wars saga, and it's this idea of the scale of hope. I wrote about this in the ebook as it relates to 1977 Star Wars, and it's basically just the idea that these are all stories of unlikely heroes who overcome great odds. And a lot of times in Star Wars, you see that that's conveyed visually. So we have those evil Star Destroyers, the huge spaceships that dominate the screen so often. They enter it and overwhelm the entire frame. And then the Rebel fighters, of course, are like these tiny insects that we see as well. Or even a shot in Star Wars, the first film, of C-3PO and R2-D2 when they're on Tatooine, the desert planet, and there are these tiny dots we see wandering across the widescreen desert landscape. I just think all of that is such a great visual metaphor for this idea of Christian hope, which is always held in the face of the realities of a broken world. And so therefore, it can kind of feel tiny in comparison. You know, when you're holding your hope amidst your own loss, your own struggle, your own sin, any hope you have can sometimes feels small. In his book, Theology of Hope, Jürgen Moltmann describes it as, quote, the passionate suffering and passionate longing kindled by the Messiah. And I think kindled is the key word there for me, this idea of keeping something alive despite the odds, despite the darkness that you might be experiencing. So to bring this all the way back to Rise of Skywalker and that favorite scene of mine, we get another visual metaphor for this when Rey and Kylo Ren, played by Adam Driver, they have that face-off on another desert planet, and she's all alone in this desert valley, just standing there, and he comes bearing down on her in this TIE fighter, just floating, you know, a couple yards above the ground, barreling towards her with great speed and force. And she's just standing there alone and still. And I think it's probably one of the highlight moments for director J.J. Abrams, where he's using different shots of her, again, alone in the frame, tiny, and then this giant ship coming at her super fast and cutting back and forth between those. And then, of course, she has that acrobatic flip right at the last moment and cuts off with her lightsaber, the wing. So it's probably the best action scene, but it also really resonated with me on this idea of the scale of hope also. Did you have a favorite scene, Claude, aside from the ones that we've kind of touched on so far?
Yeah, I really like that a lot. I think my favorite is also just the epilogue, just the end when she goes back to Luke's old stomping grounds, to his old house, and buries the lightsabers. And then the woman asks her, like, hey, you know, we haven't seen anybody around. Like, what's your name? And the look that she has to ponder and think about, you know, like, who is she really? You know, she's a Palpatine in terms of her ancestry, but she's been adopted as a Skywalker. And she looks skyward and see that sort of angelic vision of Luke and Leia. And then she's like, I'm Rey Skywalker, and just walks off. I mean, that was awesome. And I know they're playing on all the emotional heartstrings, but like, mm-hmm. man, I just buy it. They earned it. And so that's my favorite. And then close second is that desert fight scene, which is amazing.
Yeah, the epilogue, that coda really worked for me. Like you, I had a fair amount of quibbles with the film that we could probably spend time on. And those were still in my head even towards the end. But when we got that coda, it put me in the right place, the right frame of mind for a final film, and also really beautifully emphasized this idea of spiritual adoption as well. So I was a big fan of that. Anything else on the film aside from, you know, before we go into rabbit hole quibbles that you wanted to cover, maybe how would you rank this recent trilogy, just the three films themselves? It sounds, yeah, I'm going to guess that, yeah, Force Awakens is probably your favorite. Is that right?
You know, I really liked The Last Jedi. I rewatched everything getting ready to watch Rise of Skywalker, like everyone, based on, sure, Letterboxd activity. Uh-huh. Everyone was doing it, so I joined the fun. It'd be hard for me to pick between The Force Awakens and The Last Jedi. But Force Awakens was just such a, personally, a special Star Wars moment for, mm-hmm, me. Someone coming to the game late. The Last Jedi, I think I just really enjoyed because it's such an exciting movie. The fighting scene and the red and the Snoke and just that sequence was just amazing. And the first of the sort of Kylo and Rey, like the Force talking, yeah, connection thing or whatever that is.
Yep.
You know, so I really enjoyed those two. I think Rise of Skywalker is just slightly a tier down from those, but yeah, you know, I've really come around on it.
Yeah, my ranking would probably be Force Awakens. It was so fun, even though there was a lot of nostalgia embedded into it. I love the new characters we got. I probably like Last Jedi a little better than Rise of Skywalker, so I'd probably rank them as they came out. My favorite is Force Awakens. There are good things about these last two, but I do feel like there's somewhat of an opportunity lost in how things kind of veered in a bunch of different directions after that really nice setup we got with Force Awakens. But overall, I'm a fan of each of them. I think they each have some really strong things to offer. Thanks, Claude, for really stepping up to the plate on this Rise of Skywalker piece and knocking it out of the park. Again, listeners, you can read his essay. It's up right now at thinkchristian.net, or you can look for it to soon be added to our Theology of Star Wars ebook, which you can get now without it if you want. It's at thinkchristian.net/Star Wars, and we'll add Claude's essay to that shortly here. Maybe one more question, Claude. Have you had your Star Wars fill now? Do you kind of feel content with the way this ended and how much we've gotten, or would you be up for more?
I'm up for more. I think we just need a little time to breathe. Right now, actually, just it's been a lot of content. A little space would be good. I introduced my oldest son. He's 7. So we watched Star Wars, A New Hope, a couple weeks ago. And so
nice.
He's in on it. The hard part is keeping him away from everyone who knows the spoilers over the last 42 years or whatever.
Yeah.
Who was like, oh, Luke and Leia are sisters. So when he hears that, I'm like, no, they're not. He's like, oh, okay, fine. So I just lie to my son to preserve the integrity of the movies. So my next run through Star Wars will be all that stuff with him as he continues to age and develop. But it's been a good introduction so far.
I hope you felt the Force ripple over you with that flashback to Arcade Fire's 2004 debut album Funeral and a track called Rebellion, Lies, that fits this episode's Star Wars theme if you are willing to look at it from, as Obi-Wan Kenobi said, a certain point of view. And so it is with the rest of this episode's specially curated playlist. Darkness and light, sure, we play with those themes, but there's definitely more to it than that, isn't there? Fear, youth, identity, destiny, empire. As a lifelong Star Wars nerd of the highest order, this was an especially fun batch of songs to pull together. Hi, I'm John J. Thompson, and I beckon you to click on over to the Think Christian profile on Spotify, click play on this episode's playlist, and then close your eyes and feel the power of the music as it flows through you, binding us all together, uniting us in musical nerddom and wonder. There's no scum or villainy, just a fun assemblage of tunes that, if you choose to embrace it, will take you through a constellation of veiled and not so veiled references to the galaxy far, far away that so many of us wish we could call home. Later in this episode, you'll hear a bit of Kendrick Lamar's All the Stars as another teaser, but there's a lot more where that came from. Cohen, Gabriel, Holcomb, Jay-Z, NF, The National, and that's just the tip of the destroyer. If you already follow the latest episode playlist, then this batch is already there in your Spotify browser, waiting to launch. And if you're not, really, what are you waiting for? Of course, you can also find each episode's batch listed separately as well. And as always, if you think of any great songs I should add, feel free to tweet at me at John J. Thompson, and I will see what I can do. So, tune it in, turn it up, and listen already. You'll have taken your first step into a much larger reality.
Josh Larson back with the TC Podcast and more Star Wars talk. We're going to turn our attention to the Disney Plus series, The Mandalorian. And I want to bring in Sarah Welch Larson for that. Sarah, my first question isn't, do you like Baby Yoda? It's how much do you like Baby Yoda? Let me put it this way. On a scale of Porgs to Babu Frick, where do you place him?
I mean, I put Porgs pretty high on the scale, so I think they're kind of close. Very adorable.
Yeah, pretty cute, yeah. Right?
Extremely cute.
I feel bad because I started watching The Mandalorian after a few episodes had been out. So all of a sudden, Baby Yoda was everywhere. And I can't imagine what it would have been like to experience that creature in real time, having no idea it was coming. How did you first meet Baby Yoda?
So actually, my husband picked up Disney Plus specifically to watch The Mandalorian, watched the first couple of episodes, and then told me about Baby Yoda, and I didn't believe him. I watched the first two episodes back to back, and I believed him after that, and then we proceeded to watch the rest of the show together.
It is something you kind of have to see to believe, and we should probably clarify, it's actually not Baby Yoda in the series. Nope. That wouldn't work given the Star Wars timeline. So maybe, Sarah, you can explain a little bit when The Mandalorian takes place and what the basic story is.
So Mandalorian is set about 5 years after Return of the Jedi. So just after the fall of the Empire, the New Republic is trying to assert itself in the galaxy, but it's not doing a particularly great job, at least in the Outer Rim. And the main character, the Mandalorian, is a bounty hunter collecting bounties out amongst the more lawless wilds of the Star Wars universe. It's funny, actually. It kind of feels a little bit almost like Firefly to me because it's got a bit of that Wild West feel to it, with a Republic that is kind of distant and probably cares a little bit about what's going on, but not enough to actually enforce any laws.
Sure. So one of the early assignments for The Mandalorian, played by Pedro Pascal and referred to as Mando for short throughout the series, one of the early assignments is to retrieve this target. And it turns out, yes, to be a child of the same species that Yoda is, but I believe someone says the age is around 50, actually. Mm-hmm. So very tiny, very cute, as we've said, and has an inkling of powers of the Force, and actually, in certain instances, proves to be quite powerful and actually saves Mando in one case, and I think the third episode or maybe the fourth. Mm-hmm. So they have this bond, they become this pair, and as Mando decides to protect this child rather than turn him in to the person who hired him. But that sort of goes against the creed, the Mandalorian creed, because there's a whole bunch of lore that we learn. How did you understand that, Sarah? What this creed involved and what it meant to be a Mandalorian?
It's funny. I was trying to figure out some of the specifics because I knew that the show was somewhat based off the old Star Wars extended universe pre-Disney, which was scrapped when Disney took over. And Mando, in an early episode, I can't remember if it's the second or the third one, mentions that weapons are essentially his religion. But the show never really fully elaborates on that. Mm-hmm. We do understand that in Mandalorian culture, you never take off your helmet in front of another living person.
Yep.
A lot of the Mandalorians kind of live underground, sort of in hiding, and they seem to be feared by some of the rest of the galaxy. And they tend to keep to themselves other than working as bounty hunters. But one of the things that they repeat to each other pretty regularly is this phrase, it is the way, it is the way. And we don't ever really fully understand what the way is. We just know that they have a creed that they adhere to and they're pretty strict about it.
Yeah. It's interesting to trace as he, you know, decides not to follow through on this assignment that really does come across as something of a rejection of this creed or this ethos that he belongs to as well. So how did you trace that? It seems to me that's where some of the theological resonance in the series was there, in that tension between this calling he had that is really one of violence as a mercenary and a mm-hmm. bottom line game to one that is more of caring and in some instances sacrifice or at least risking himself to keep this child alive. How did you kind of trace that transition throughout the show? Did you find that was rewarding or kind of thinly explored?
It's funny. I actually think that he was coming to a slightly better understanding of whatever this creed is, because the Mandalorians as a people do tend to pick up foundlings. Like they call them foundlings, like kids that have been abandoned or otherwise are not being cared for by society. And they tend to take these foundlings in and train them and then adopt them as their own. So I actually found Mando's taking in the child, the baby Yoda, as a kind of living more closely into that creed. Maybe he didn't understand it at first, because it seems to be something that he slowly comes around to over the course of the show.
Yeah, that's some of the delight is kind of seeing him get worn down by the child, right? The antics and becoming a little more caring. But you're right. It goes back even to how Mando was brought in as a child himself into this group where he was abandoned and rescued. We eventually find out in a later episode. So it does come a little bit full circle there. You mentioned this idea of the steel helmet and how he has to wear it. And of course, the motif of masks is one that goes all throughout the Star Wars saga. Think of Kylo Ren's helmet in the more recent trilogy and really go back to Darth Vader's famous helmet, which Ren, interestingly, in these recent films, what's left of it, he worships it almost as this religious icon. And it does make me think that masks mythologize, essentially. They do so in Star Wars for sure, but they also do in real life by creating these personas that are different from who we are beneath the mask. So there's this distinction often between who we want to be and who we really are. Masks can be a false front. And in real life, you know, it can be anything from, I don't know, maybe a grade point average. Maybe it's a job title you kind of hide behind a little bit or an inflated.
A Twitter persona.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Social media, it's all over, right? People kind of inflating their personas, mythologizing themselves. And all of this reminds me, when I think of Luke 12 and Jesus' description of the hypocrisy of the Pharisees, it reminds me of how Eugene Peterson translated that in the Message, where he says the Pharisees would wear a religious mask. And I think he's speaking there of their misguidedness, but also the way they were sort of trapped by their stiff, self-righteous identities. So I'm curious how you saw this playing out, Sarah, in The Mandalorian with the mask, this helmet of steel that he wears, because it is something of a badge of honor to wear this. Others, when they encounter him, they're in awe of it. And it's almost something that's honorable. Yet there is that moment in the finale where he finally does remove it. And it's played like an epiphany, as if this is a move forward for the character. So I do wonder, do you think Mando is hiding something under there, or does the mask provide a more virtuous purpose in The Mandalorian?
I think if he's hiding anything, he's hiding himself from the world, as in he doesn't really fully want to be exposed to it. And I think the epiphany that you're talking about also has to do with him coming to understand other people that he might be prejudiced towards. I'm kind of trying to dance around spoilers. I don't know how much we want to talk about.
I think with the final episode being out, we could probably dig into it. We'll use this as a warning for people who are still making their way through it that you might want to skip ahead a couple minutes here. But yeah, you're right. He doesn't take the helmet off. Actually, it's a droid who takes it off for him in order to save his life. And so, yeah, talk a little bit about that distinction you see there.
Yeah, it's interesting. He's very highly prejudiced against droids because of that backstory where his parents were killed and he was taken in by the Mandalorians. And throughout the rest of his life, he takes that to mean that droids are basically only capable of doing what they were originally programmed for. And for the most part, most of the droids he runs into are bounty hunter droids or battle droids. And for him, there's no grace in that. So he's just going to push those aside. He wants to avoid droids as much as possible. And then it turns out that there is a droid that has been reprogrammed from being a bounty hunter droid to a caretaker.
Yeah,
that's taking care of him.
Like a nurse droid, right?
Exactly. And I think for him, that moment where he realizes that this droid isn't what it used to be, it's become something different and something better. I think that's an epiphany for him because he realizes that if this droid can be that, then maybe the world doesn't have to be that way necessarily either. I don't know if he's ever going to willingly take off the mask in front of another living person.
Yeah.
But I think that's an interesting step in what I think might be the right direction for him.
Well, and as you're describing it, maybe it opens up who he can be as well, you know, that he is defined by this helmet. And you're right, he probably will go back to obeying that creed and keeping it on, but it has opened up new possibilities in that the faces he immediately sees may not always mean exactly what he thinks they do, even if it's the face of a droid. Do you have a favorite mask? I guess I'm curious, if you think about all of the ones that we've seen throughout all of these Star Wars films, is there one that comes to mind first when you think of Star Wars? Is there a face or a masked face that comes to mind first? I don't know if it's my absolute favorite, but I did like the cameo by the Sand People here in The Mandalorian in this series. They have that mummy-like wrapping around their heads and those goggles. So that's one that I always think of, maybe because it was one of the first Star Wars faces I saw with the original 1977 film. So it's kind of burned in my memory there. But is there another one that always comes to mind to you when you think of Star Wars?
Yeah, actually, the first one that actually came to mind for me was it isn't even really a mask. It's the blast shield down that Luke has when he's first training to become a Jedi under Obi-Wan.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, when they're en route to Alderaan. Truth be told, Darth Vader's probably the first mask that I think of.
It's the most iconic. But yeah, the one you're talking about is where the shield comes down and he can't see out of it, right? So it kind of blinds him, but it's part of his training. And yeah, there's a lot of potency in that moment because it comes to be about trust and, you know, relinquishing control. And that's
about relearning how to see the world, I think, in a way that I think Mando certainly learns how to do over the course of the TV series as well.
Yeah, I think that's true. Anything else about The Mandalorian you wanted to touch on? Are you interested in a second season? They have announced that there is going to be one. I think it'll probably come out sometime in the fall. Is that something that sounds good to you? Or do you feel like you've kind of had your full of this particular narrative in the Star Wars universe?
I am interested to see where they go. There are a lot of very interesting side characters that I would like to see more of. And I'm curious about where Mando ends up going and where he ends up developing. The thing that I appreciate about the character the most at this point is he seems to be quiet and he seems to kind of take a backstage to some of the other characters that he meets with on the way. And speaking of the Tusken Raiders, there's this lovely little moment in, I think, episode 5, where Mando comes across a couple of Tusken Raiders and communicates with them using the sign language that they speak.
Yeah.
And one of the actors who played the Tusken Raider is actually deaf. Like, sign language is their first language. And I thought that was a fascinating note because it's kind of adding some of that Old West coloring, you know, communicating in sign language with people that you can't speak with. But it was also a good way to humanize characters that Star Wars hasn't really ever treated as people before. I think the same people have always been some sort of set coloring or plot device, but they've never really been treated as actual human beings. So
I
really like
figures
that touch.
Too, right? Always as frightening figures, yeah.
And in this particular scene, it's maybe 20 seconds at most, but Mando mentions that he and the person he's traveling with are on their land, so he's going to ask their permission to cross it. And so I'd love to see more like that from this show, so I'll be watching for that for sure.
Yeah, I did like when it took these little turns into tiny corners of the Star Wars universe and took its time with them as well. I mean, I'm not one who needs, Claude Atcho and I talked about this when it came to Rise of Skywalker. I don't always need Star Wars in my life. So it's not that I'm desperate for more content as it would be, but I do like The Mandalorian in that it was a little slower paced and it gave us peeks into these little pockets of a really fascinating universe that's lived in my head for so many years. So I would probably be up for watching a few more episodes when this does come out again in the fall. Jumping real quickly back to the masks idea, just to note that I wrote more about masks specifically as they relate to The Force Awakens in our Theology of Star Wars ebook. So there's a little more there if listeners are interested. Sarah, you've written about Solo, a Star Wars story for the Think Christian website. So that post is up there at thinkchristian.net if people are interested. Thanks for revisiting the galaxy once again with me here for the show.
Always happy to talk about Star Wars. Thanks, Josh.
Bring a bullet, bring a sword, bring a morgue, but you can't bring the truth to me. You and all your expectations, I don't even want your congratulations. I recognize your false confidence and calculated promises, all in your conversation. I hate people that feel entitled.
All the stars there from Kendrick Lamar with SZA. We didn't get to all the Star Wars, but we did cover the most recent stories from that saga. As you can tell from that selection, John J. Thompson had a lot of fun picking songs for the Spotify playlist that accompanies this episode. You heard Arcade Fire's Rebellion earlier, and there are all sorts of other Star Wars-related tracks over on Spotify. Just search for the Think Christian playlist. Thank you for that, John, and thanks also to Sarah Welch Larson and Claude Acho for joining me to talk Star Wars. You can find Sarah on Twitter at Dodgy Boffin, and Claude is at Claude Acho. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, I'm at Larson on Film. And as for TC, just look for us at Think Christian. Now, I've mentioned our Theology of Star Wars ebook a couple of times. It's a great collection of essays, I really think so, but my favorite part might be the original character illustrations by Skylar Rosenbaum. You'll want to download the ebook just for those alone. They look fantastic on an iPad. Again, you can get that for free at thinkchristian.net/Star Wars. Now, our next episode is going to be a bit of a different format. I've convinced someone that I'm sure you're familiar with, Karen Swallow Pryor, to come on the podcast. She's written for us a number of times over the years, but is always extremely busy, so I'm happy that I was able to convince her to drop by for the show and talk about Greta Gerwig's Little Women. Karen had a nice write-up about the film for the Gospel Coalition, so we're going to dig into that and more. As we kick off our second year, considering how pop culture fandom resonates with the Christian faith, we could still use your help reaching new listeners, getting the word out. So tell a friend or a family member, and maybe also leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Really easy to do if you're listening right now. Just find our show page in Apple Podcasts, scroll down, you could leave a star rating and also write a review. We would appreciate it. If you want to email me directly with a question or a comment about the show, I'm Josh Larson, and you can do that at jlarsen@reframemedia.com. That's J-L-A-R-S-E-N @reframemedia.com. The Think Christian podcast is a production of Reframe Media, a family of programs designed to help you see your whole life reframed by God's gospel story. Visit reframemedia.com for more info. Our audio engineer and post-production supervisor is John Reeder, and Reframe's co-director overseeing content strategy is Robin Baslin. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you again soon.